listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kolula. We're going to jump right into this interview with a very good friend of mine. We go way back to our days of working at Guitar Center 20 years ago, Mr. Yuri Gelman. How are you, Yuri?
How are you doing, Nikki? Nice to see you.
Good to see you too, bro. So you and I go way back. You were in, it wasn't called Pro Tools. It was called, what was the department you were in Guitar Center?
Pro Audio.
Pro Audio. Yeah. You were pro something. So you and I met, I think it was 2002, 2003. But We go way back, man. And those were like, you know, there's a brotherhood when you were in the trenches with people that you like at a store like that, because you're like you're seeing so many artists and musicians, so you're in your tribe, but then there's this corporate America, you know, that you're also battling with and trying to work with and trying to balance all that. So but now you've been working in this amazing studio, you've been mixing artists, you've been recording artists. Tell me a little bit about you starting to play music in Argentina and then coming to Los Angeles. Tell me what that process was like. What was the moment of Zen that made you want to be a musician?
Well, I think I always wanted to be a musician, even if I didn't know I wanted to be a musician, if that makes any sense.
Of course.
But when I was a little kid, you know, I stole my dad's vinyls and I learn how to use the turntable just to listen to the Beatles and, you know, all his good, you know, great record collection. That I was like 3 years old and playing vinyls.
That's awesome.
I don't know how I figured that out. I can't figure other things out in life.
Well, and it's also the needle is so small and you have to get it right on the tracks.
Yeah.
You know?
So funny story, I was 3-4 years old and I thought the Beatles live inside the speakers.
That's awesome.
So I would kind of come and listen to them sing to me, right? So, but when I was 3-4 years old, I knew all their songs. My parents took me to every Beatles movie that they were playing in Argentina, and it would bring my.
Did they play them in English or in Spanish?
In English, but you know, I didn't, you know, I was a kid, but all I knew was the songs. And, you know, I just brought my little toy guitar and play along with them.
That's awesome, dude.
So fast forward, you know, I just, in school, I was always, just drawn more to music. When we had to learn how to play, I think, flute and read music, I learned how to read music on my own, because you have the picture of the flute and the note and the staff, and I just figured it out too. And music was natural to me all the time. And then growing up, started playing guitar, you know, I got, I met rock and roll, and I got.
Do you remember what the band was or the song was that made you fall in love with it?
I don't know if it's a song, because I don't have a favorite song. It depends on the mood I'm in. I listen to different artists, but I would say, obviously, the Beatles were, you know, a huge influence and still are on me. But, you know, just more, you know, like Kiss, Van Halen, all these kind of more of a in-your-face rock. My dad had a lot of vinyls of live music, you know, like Woodstock and Live in Bangladesh and all these great concerts that I would listen to, you know, when I was a kid. So, you know, that was it. And, you know, I started playing in bands.
You were in high school when you started, like, playing in bands or after?
Yeah, right. You know, like, started kind of getting a little bit more, I don't know if serious is the word, because I was just having fun. I was not really thinking of a career or anything like that. But in high school, I started playing guitar more often. And after high school, that's when I really went into being in bands and playing out. And you know, just I decided that then I decided I wanted to be a musician.
That's awesome because, you know, everybody, this is one of my favorite questions to ask, especially musicians, even artists in general, because, you know, you and I have known each other for so long and I've never known all these little details that drew you to music. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, these are like really important moments for each of us that kind of like, you know, propelled us to fall in love with music, you know? So you were all of a sudden head into bands and jamming. And then do you remember the moment where you were like, this I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to take it seriously. And I think you went to music school. You either went to MI or you went somewhere else in Argentina.
I went to MI. Well, in Argentina, I went to,
I lost your audio for some reason. Are you there? Hello? Can you hear me? I can't hear you for some reason. Sam, can we see if there's something? What's going on? Did you push something in your phone or anything? Let's see. Sam says, Yuri, check your settings. We lost you for a quick second. I don't know what happened. Hold on. We'll get it, right? That's so weird. It just turned off for some reason. Did you just, all right, we're gonna log you off and have you log back in. So just click on the link, okay? Don't worry. All right. All right. There's a weird echo now, Sam.
Can you hear me now?
All right. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but we have an echo. And
is that better?
Yeah, it is better. I got a phone call came in. Should I put it on airplane mode or something? Or is it?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's why. Maybe that it probably muted it for that reason.
No problem. So let me put it in airplane mode. Is that okay?
Yeah, no problem.
Hold on.
I'm getting a good view of your finger right now.
Hold on.
That's all right.
Where am I?
All right, just leave it as is, he said.
Okay. So let me get this. Okay.
All right. So you said you were in Argentina and you went to a music school. What was that music school?
It's it's like a conservatory. It's like a junior school. Basically, I was taking lessons, you know, like different teachers, people that I saw play and I liked, they, you know, how they played, and I called them, and, you know, just usual, you know, whatever, you know, everybody's doing. And I wanted to study classical music, but I didn't have money to do that. So
you wanted to do classical guitar? I didn't know that. That's crazy.
Well, I wanted to learn classical music,
right?
You know, have a better foundation. And so that's cool. If you, it's not it's a public school, but it's like at the level of Juilliard and the best schools in the world. So, and you have to pass a test that is really, really hard. And everybody kept telling me that I was, you know, I'm not a classical guitar player, so I'm not gonna enter, so I should give up. And that made me wanna try more.
Right.
And I aced the test and the wow. first try. So yeah, it is crazy. I was surprised, but I was there for about almost 4 years, and I never wanted to be a classical musician. So at one point I had enough, and I left. And that's when I decided to go to MI here in Los Angeles.
And you, how did you hear of MI? Was MI like a known school over in Argentina? I know it's known here because I live here, you know?
Yeah, I had, I met some guys from Argentina, great guitar players that went to MI. So I made friends with them. I talked to them and you know, just made it here. You know.
Who was the guitar teacher that you were most excited to study with over there?
Oh, wow. There's so many. So when I was there, well, Jennifer Batten was teaching.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
And she's
Michael Jackson's guitarist, right?
Yeah, Michael Jackson guitar player. And she's amazing. She played with Jeff Beck and Michael Jackson. I mean, like, amazing guitar player. Joe DiOrio was there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Joe DiOrio was a teacher at USC, too. I love that guy.
Yeah.
He passed, like, maybe a year ago, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. Then Steve Trovato was there.
Yeah, Steve Trovato at USC, too. That's awesome.
Yeah, amazing country player. My private counselor or teacher, whatever you want to call it, her name was or is Beth Marlis, and now she's the head of GIT of the guitar department.
Was Frank Gambaldi there when you were there?
Frank Gambaldi, no, he just left the school. He would come to do some clinics and stuff like that, but he wasn't teaching anymore. Then Russ Parrish from what's the band? No, I forgot the name. He played with Rob Halford. He's in Steel Panther now. He's the guitar player from Steel Panther.
Oh, wow.
He's an amazing guitar player. You see,
so you were like in the world of giants, learning from them. That must have been a little intimidating at first, right?
Yeah, it was intimidating. I'm a bit of a sociopath, so I don't care. So, right. Anytime that I had the opportunity to play with or just hang out with those people, I would do it. And same with when I started recording and mixing, I would, you know, people saying, hey, you know, I'm looking for a studio, and I would raise my hand instead of thinking that I couldn't do it, you know. So,
wow. So
I just, you know, and that's how I learned, you know, just going and making mistakes and learning from the mistakes.
That's so crazy because I didn't know Joe DiOrio. You know, I was a classical student at USC, and, you know, like all the jazz musicians were kind of like congregated always together. And I was friends with some of them, the ones in my class. But Joe DiOrio was one of those teachers that he would just sit in the lounge, you know, in between classes. And I would just sit next to him and just like soak up so much about jazz and just like how things kind of evolved in that art form, what he was doing. He was talking to me about, he did a record, Giant Steps, and, you know, he ended up doing all these other records, and was talking about, you know, how he approaches. He was the last person to touch Wes Montgomery's guitar. I don't know if he ever told you that, but he and Wes Montgomery did a concert together, and he was the last one to play Wes Montgomery's guitar, and then Wes Montgomery died, I think, 1 or 2 days later. Isn't that crazy? So crazy.
Yeah.
So I hold Joe DiOrio in the highest esteem. All right, so you're at MI, you finished the program, and then you started a band? Did you immediately the recording? How did you make that transition?
Well, you know, just finished school. I graduated with honors, and I said, okay, well, now I need to find a band. You know, I did all these things. I studied classical, went to MI, and I just prepared myself to be the best musician I could be. So I bought a Porter studio, a four-track Porter studio, and started making demos. And I was bouncing tracks, you know, like recording all that. There was so much hiss that you couldn't hear anything because I was just so many generations on a cassette tape. And this is, I mean, I'm dating myself now, but this is early 90s, right? 93, 94.
I had a four-track. You know what's so crazy? I don't know if you ever experienced this. When I would use a four-track, I wouldn't really hear that hiss as pronounced as when I took that tape and put it in a player to show somebody else. And then it was just oh my God, it's so loud.
Yeah. So I met this girl and I showed her some of my songs, and she was in film school and trying to raise money for her first film. She said, okay, I like your songs. Why don't you write songs for my movie? I said, cool, that's great. But I said, I can't do it with this. I need a bigger, something better. So back then, they had the 8-track Porter Studio, same thing, same cassette tape, but 8-tracks. So I got that one of those, and that was like opening a whole new world for me because I can have drums in 2 tracks and bass in 1 track and guitars, each one on their own track. And I would still do some bounces to get more stuff because I always wanted to try
good
things. So I recorded that, you know, I wrote the music for her movie, and I don't know what happened with that movie, but that somehow my cassette tape started making the rounds, and I got a publishing deal out of somebody passing my demo.
Awesome.
So, you know, I got that. Then about at that time I was doing an internship at Warner Chapel. So I learned all the other side of the publishing.
The business. Publishing.
Right. Yeah. So it was cool. Then, you know, after a while, I went back to Argentina trying to raise more money. I didn't want to get a day job. I wanted to make music. So all that effort that I did, you know, studying and moving to a different country, I didn't want to just get a day job.
So
went back to Argentina. The plan was to work for a few months and come back to LA, and I started making really good money playing music there. I started doing sessions, teaching, and you know, I was making my living, you know, with music. So I decided to stay there for, you know, like that's what I was wanting to do. So and that's when I got interested in recording.
Right.
You know, going to studios, I didn't like how the tone the engineers were getting out of my, you know, my gear.
Guitar.
Yeah, and I knew back then, even, you know, if I was a young musician, I knew that anybody would hire me based on my last recording.
Right.
So if they liked the tone, what I did last time I had a session, they will hire me back. So I had this, not argument, but, you know, just talking to the engineers, and they sometimes some people, you know, just they are burned out and they don't care much. It's another gig.
Sometimes with sound guys and engineers, there's a little bit of a know-it-all vibe that you hit, yeah. And it's tough to kind of work around or with that sometimes.
It is. It's the old school, crusty old engineer that even they work in a basement. They never go out, and they hate their life because, you know, they just lost the passion for what they're doing.
Right.
And so
you just pissed off a lot of engineers, by the way.
well, no, that's the old school.
I'm just kidding. I know.
And you know what? The best engineers in the world, they will tell you that they get so much work, not because of their technical skills, but because of their people skills.
Right.
And, you know, all the, you know, Grammy winners and all these people, they're all cool.
Yeah.
They're great to hang out with.
Right.
You know, so, you know, it's just need to put your happy face when you're working with other people. You know,
and so. you kind of made this transition. This is what I really love about you too. It's like you have this attention to detail as a guitar player, and then you shifted a lot of that energy into learning recording, Pro Tools, EQ, mixing. Tell me what that process was like for you, and then we'll talk a little bit about your studio as well.
Sure. So back then when I was doing sessions and I, you know, I decided I was going to go to a recording school, not a full program. I just wanted to know the same to speak the same language that engineers would speak.
Right.
Okay. So know about microphones, know about, you know, like the basic stuff. I never ever wanted to be an engineer. I never thought I would be any good being, you know, like doing recording.
Right.
But when I was at school, I realized I liked it. And so I started, it was a once a week thing for 2 years. It wasn't like intensive or anything like that. Just super basic miking techniques. And you got to touch the console once a month.
And you probably like were you doing tape, or was it digital then?
It was digital tape. It was okay. It was Tascam, the DA88.
The DATs, right?
Yeah, no, not DATs. That was the bounce.
So what's media. Digital tape?
The DA88 was an ADAT,
but okay.
Made by Tascam.
Okay.
The Tascam had the DA88. And Alesis had the ADATs back then. Okay. So I wanted to get more experience on, you know, hands-on recording. So I started asking, hey, you know, I'll come to the studio when you have a client and I'll, you know, just stay here. Let me watch. And they had their own team until one day, I guess somebody couldn't make it and they called me. And I thought, great, you know, I'm going to be in a session, and my first session with a band. And I get there, say, okay, we're going to be here at midnight. So from midnight to 4 or 5 in the morning. I said, great. I was like, thank you. Yeah, anytime, you know, right?
So
I go there, and the band is kind of sitting up and say, well, what do I do? Well, you sit over here.
Right.
And when you need anything, we'll let you know.
Man, that's what I'm doing.
Well, but that's you know, that's how pretty much everybody starts.
Right.
I did it for about a month, and while I still going to, I was still attending to school, doing internships at the studio at, you know, from midnight to 4 or 5 in the morning. And this studio called asking for engineers. They recommended me. I went for the interview and I got the gig. It was it was a voiceover studio that, you know, they work for HBO, Fox, Discovery Channel, doing all the voiceover from English to Spanish.
Oh, wow.
So I really learned over there how to work on a fast pace. You know, we were, everything I recorded there was watched by, you know, around the world on HBO or anywhere, right? So so it was a great experience. I was there for a few years. Then I moved back. And that's when we met, basically.
That's crazy. And you know what? What's awesome, it's like, you know, there's this, what I love about Guitar Center, and this is one thing that I actually attribute to the company, you have all these people that are drawn to gear and music and making music. So it's like you show up and everybody's either in a band or wanting to be an artist or wanting to be a producer. And there are all these different facets and you have these quick exchanges. And I remember having these like quick exchanges with you about gear. And it was mostly like, we were like horsing around or like, you know, we were talking about, you know, just like music in general. And then, you know, I think you knew my first guitarist, Anthony King from Miami. Mm-hmm. And we had all these like parallels and we started just hanging out a little bit more. And then you started getting way into recording and now you have this amazing studio. We're going to talk about it a little bit. And it is formerly Aspen Pittman's recording studio that he's been putting together, but you have now elevated that space and made it this incredible place to work in. And you and I have been working, you know, almost every week on this new trio project that I've been doing. And I remember we went out to lunch and you were like, yeah, you should come by the studio and check it out. And anytime I hear that, I always just picture it's like my room in the back right now. It's like I've got stuff here in a little room and that I can record, but it's like not a real studio. And then I walk into your studio and you have all these ribbon mics like right behind you, all these microphones. Mm-hmm. From the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And then you have all these incredible mics that we've been working with. Let's talk a little bit about some of those mics because they are incredibly special and they have history and they have stories. And let's just say they have some magic. So what do you want to show us first?
So let me walk you a little bit. Let me flip the camera.
Yeah.
See, I need to figure out how to do it here with this app.
You can just do it just like that, you know, the way you're doing it. Yeah, just.
Okay, yeah, so let me show you. So here we have some preamps. These are two mic pre's and compressors. They are all designed by Aspen Pittman. This is the Supri. It's a stereo unit preamp.
And let's make a little note that Aspen Pittman was the founder and inventor of Groove Tubes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which a lot of musicians know. I think Fender bought it, and you know that's when it's what's in a lot of Fender amps, and a lot of it, they're just known for being some of the best tubes, right?
Yes. Well, Fender amps has been shipped with Groove Tubes, vacuum tubes, right?
Right.
For I don't know, maybe I would say 30 years. So wow. every time you bought a Fender amp, it had Groove Tubes.
Amazing.
Yeah. So that's how he started the company with tubes, and then went on to design microphones, mic preamps. The guitar amps are incredible. They're some of the best ever made. And I'm not saying that because, you know, Aspen was my father-in-law, but, you know, people love those amps, great tone. A lot of artists were playing with them, you know, Billy Gibbons, Jerry Garcia played with, you know, they played Groove Tube amps, okay? So those are some of the mic pre's he made. There's another one that's called the Vipri that is right here. So it's a single unit. And these are all two
preamps.
Pre's and compressors, yes.
Right.
So it's like we have 32 channels of two micro-amps going into Pro Tools.
That's awesome.
So you get all the, you know, vibe and color from
warmth. You know, I think the warmth is the most important, you know, when you're recording, because it's like you hear it. Yeah. You hear it right away. It's like, and when it's going through, you know, gear and processing like that, and it already sounds good, it probably makes your work a little bit easier when you're mixing, right?
Yeah, it was a learning curve for me to get it sounding the way I want it, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, I figured it out, and people like the way, you know, the studio sounds. It has its own sound and vibe. It's not like recording in any other studio.
Let's just do a quick walk through the room so everybody can see how awesome the studio is, okay?
So this is the control room. So I'm going to turn it around.
Yep.
Okay.
Very awesome.
Yeah. So we have some Urey monitors right there with Macintosh power amps. And then here's the mic collection you were talking about.
So amazing.
Yeah, and I would say that 95% of these are in working condition.
Incredible.
And I use them in sessions. There's more here.
So awesome.
Yeah, this mic right here is one of the first dynamic mics ever made in 1930s.
You know, Jack White actually put one of those in a guitar.
Yeah, well, this is the cable, you see it here?
Right.
It's the original cable.
Wow.
From 1930s.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I use them. I use them a lot. You know, like, hold on. These mics here, the RCA 77DX.
Yeah.
I use them for my drum room microphones.
There's a lot of give with those old school mics. You know, the older the mics, I almost find that it's a little bit less brittle in some ways if you know how to use them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the control room. This is the live room. I'm going to pan slow.
Yeah. Here. Tilt it a little bit down. Tilt it a little bit down just so you can see more of the room. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't.
Yeah, that's perfect.
So,
man, so amazing. I love this space. It's just, and I love that you have a little Ludwig kit just already set up.
Yeah, it's a 1962 Ludwig kit with a 1961 Supraphonic.
Tilt it down just a little bit, Urey.
I don't see it, so I can't see.
Yeah, that's okay. That's all right. That angle is pretty good.
Okay. So this is the same era of drum kit that Ringo and Bonham used to play.
Amazing. Okay.
Have some vintage amps here. A 70s vibratone. It's like a guitar Leslie.
Tilt it down a little bit. A little bit more. Yeah, there you go.
Like awesome. That. Cool. Yep. 1957 Magnatone.
Amazing.
This is we used it the other day on a session, 1964 Deluxe Reverb.
Yeah.
And sounds amazing. Here's my bass area, if you can see it.
Yeah, you got the acoustic bass amp. I've got one, but you got the big one. You got the jumbo one.
Yeah, that's a Dual 15, early 70s Dual 15 acoustic.
And let's talk about that bass. You got a vintage bass there.
Yes, a 1963 P bass.
Amazing.
And it's an early 2000 sidekick. You know, it's
just one of the few. A little bit more, Urey. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, cool. Cool. So that, and then in this section, we got
you got a Rhodes.
Rhodes.
You got a little Hammond.
Chinese Rhodes.
So amazing.
Hammond. A 1950 Steinway upright.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Steinways are the best.
Yeah, and this is what I call my wall of tone. A lot of vintage and custom shop group tubes amps.
And Aspen, were these like, when he made these or designed them, were they like one of 100, one of one? Like, how did he do these?
Well, they had a production line. So, you know, they were making amps, right?
Right.
That would be like this solo that you see the black toe lick regular finishing. That was a regular production. These ones here, that the Tolex is different and the grill is, that was painted, hand painted by Aspen. Those are the custom shop, and he used to actually work on them when somebody ordered a custom shop. Okay. So, and then I have a, this is a, I don't know if you can see it well.
Yeah.
It's an Electro. It's made by, it was made by Rickenbacker. It's 1947. And it works amazing for blues and kind of early rock. And then here we have some more gear on this, the vocal booth.
I've been living in most of the time when we do sessions.
Yeah. So again, more vintage amps, you know, a 70s Trainer, an Ampeg. This is the V40 and the V20, I think it's called.
It's tilted a little bit more, step back. Yeah, that's perfect.
That one, that Ampeg, you know, the Stones used to play with the 20-watt version on their earlier recordings.
That's crazy.
So this is a Marshall JMP. This is early 70s JTM. 50-watt. This Group Tubes Trio.
Let's show them a little bit, because I've been using this a lot and I love the tone out of this amp.
Yeah.
Head.
So this is a guitar pre, and was designed by Aspen. And this is what Jerry Garcia used to play.
So amazing.
It has three channels: clean, mean, and scream.
That's all you need right there.
So now this mean channel, I don't know if you can see it here.
Yeah.
That was actually, that channel was designed by Bogner. You know the...
They're one of my favorite amps.
Well, he's from Germany. His first gig here in the U.S. was with Group Tubes.
Wow.
And he designed that channel. And then this is Fender Tremolux, 1963. This is what Clapton used to play with when he was in Cream.
Cream. Back up a little bit. Let's see the amp and the head. Yeah. Oh, my God.
And it's really, really good. It's like, they are very loud. And
just tilt it a little bit more, Yuri. Yeah, there you go. Yep.
Cool.
Amazing. How many watts is that? Do you know?
That's 40 watts, but, you know, they can blow your head. You know, they get pretty loud.
And let's show the space station monitor that you have.
So the space station, it's something that Aspen designed. He's worked on this technology for about 20, 30 years too, probably. And before he passed, he launched this company.
Just back up a little bit, Yuri, so we can get a better view.
Yeah. So basically, perfect. Space station, you see, it's a stereo, like an immersive 3D sound from a single cabinet. Okay. And I know it's hard to understand if you don't hear it, but you need to hear it. You can come to the NAMM show if you're in LA. We'll show you how it works. But basically, one speaker can fill the entire room.
Amazing. And I've actually listened to that. And what's so crazy is you hear a mix of it in front of you, and you can go to any room and it's omnidirectional, and you can hear the same relative mix in any room. Crazy. It's so crazy.
Yeah, because it is an immersive 3D sound.
Real quick, before we get into mics, let's play something that you've mixed so we get to some of the music. What do you want to play us first?
I don't know what you guys have ready, and
you pick of the three. We've got them all ready.
Of the three, okay. Well, the first band could be South Central. That's a band from Greg Sutton. That he's an amazing songwriter. He played with Bob Dylan, Clapton. He wrote songs for Joe Bonamassa, Joe Cocker.
Wow.
I mean, this is a big time guy that's super humble. And they came here with his new band. They recorded, we did 7 songs, all played live in 3 days with vocals and everything. Just all like, so they did this classic Chain Gang.
All right, here it is. Here's Chain Gang.
That's the sound of us men working on the chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and wearing a crown. You hear them moaning their loud words, then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Working on a chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah. I hear someone saying, I'm going home one of these old days. I'm going home to see my woman whom I love so. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Gang, I hear someone say, that's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain, chain, yeah. Oh, da, 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 da. Oh, working so hard. Somebody said, this is tough, y'all. Yes, alright. Give me water, I'm thirsty. Sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah. That's the sound of us men working on a chain. Yeah, yeah. That's the sound of us men working on the chain. Game.
Sounds killing, man. It's one of my favorite songs. Cool. It's an R&B classic made famous by Sam Cooke, right?
Yep.
Yeah, man. So you recorded that. I remember you told me about this session. They all came and did it kind of live, right? All one take?
Yeah, they came to the studio about a month before, tracking. And because they had a concept that they wanted to do. And the idea was to, they wanted to recreate Exile on Main Street from the Stone, you know, about by the Stones, not to do the covers, but just get the same vibe of the, you know, live recording. And they say, you know what, we embrace some bleed on the tracks, you know, we don't want it separated. And so they recorded all live, and we did that like if it was tape, so no, with no click. So 2-3 versions of each song and one after the other, and you would choose the best one. No editing.
That's no, awesome.
Everything that you hear is played live the way they played it. Nothing was edited. No vocal tuning, no time alignment, and it sounds awesome.
Yeah,
and
like that's awesome.
The harmonies.
You're one of the first people that showed me, you know, like I've always recorded to a click, and you kind of showed me, like, you know, don't record to a click, because your time, if your time is good, then let it naturally kind of play out the way it's going to play out. And I love it because it actually gives songs a little bit of breathing room, whereas, you know, like when you're kind of like, you know, have this allegiance to the click, it can sound a little bit stiff. And I think a lot of records suffer sometimes because of that. But it's been kind of refreshing to kind of, you know, not play to a click. Oh, at the same time, there are some things where when it comes to editing, where it's like, oh man, we didn't play to a click. But if you get the take right, we can make it right. You know what I mean? So
exactly, yeah.
That's all that matters. So I love that. I love that. That's your approach to capturing the magic.
Yeah, I mean, you need to have some minimum level of musicianship,
like, right,
in order. And I'm not saying to be a virtuoso. You just need to know your bandmates and be used to play with them, so you know when they're rushing, when they're kind of laying back on the tempo, and that's the natural push and you know, pull and push that of the song that, right, makes it more exciting.
Let's talk a little bit about these microphones that you have, because I want to showcase those. Okay. They are really something special.
So yeah, so let me show you really quick. We have a couple, like quite a few different mics here with a lot of history. This is a U47. I'll show you right now. If you can see it right here.
Yeah.
U47. This one at one point, if you can see the sticker, it says here, let me see.
Abbey Road, that's right.
So at one point in the life of this mic, it belonged to Abbey Road.
You know what's so crazy about that is you used to listen to the Beatles and your old three-year-old self, yeah, the Beatles in your record, and now you've got mics from their studio, which
is true. So I never thought about it that way, but yeah, it's true. This is a U48. So right here, it's the same microphone that the U47. Not now, the
different capsule. It has a different capsule.
Well, no, the capsule is the same. It's wired different. So, this one can capture figure eight, like from the front and from the back, and all also just from the front, a cardioid pattern. The 47 can do a cardioid just from the front and a omnidirectional. And it's just a cable that they wired it different. It's the same microphone.
Okay? That's awesome.
So this next mic that I'm gonna show you, it's a really cool mic with a lot of history. So basically when David Foster, the producer, had a studio, he called Whitney Houston. They did a session. He rented a mic from this rental company, a C12, and the session was so good that every time she went to his studio, they requested the very same mic from the they asked not for the model, that is a C12, but they requested the serial number. So the same exact mic. And this is the mic. and they nicknamed it the Whitney.
So turn it a little bit. Turn it a little bit so you can see the. Yeah, there it is, the Whitney.
Woo! And this is
chills.
Yeah, and this is the mic. Let me show you here. This is the mic where this is the one she used to record. Bodyguard.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Her famous and probably best vocal that she's ever done. Yeah, was on that microphone. And you know what's crazy? You know, I've done a couple tracks on that microphone. Every time I use it, I get crazy amounts of chills, man. It's really weird. I feel like it has some magic, you know? So that definitely has some magic fairy dust around it, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot of inspiration when you know the history of the mic, right?
Right.
So let me put this the camera down for a second. I need to open this. That I can't do it with one hand, okay?
Well, let's do this. Let's play another song because I want to make sure we get to the music.
Oh, cool.
What do you want to play next while you get this next mic ready?
Okay, we can do the YouTube video if you want. It's from a band called Resistentes from Argentina. It's an amazing band with a lot of, they've been in a lot of bands and they're really well known in South America, all the musicians. And this is their first single. Now we're working on their full length. And it's like a hard rock song, just, you know, fist up and just pumping.
All right, let's hear it. Here it goes.
Cool.
Más
atacar, ¿qué va a pelear? ¿Qué va a decir lo que es verdad? Ya sin dudar, sin negociar, hay que romper, hay que quebrar.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yuri, we're running out of time, so real quick, where can people find your studio online if they want to come and record and work with you and also send you recordings for you to mix as well?
Cool. So the studio is called Voodoo Doll Productions. So the email address is voodoodollproductions.com. It's VOODOODOLL. Productions, productions. And I went on this.
That's right. Very good.
I want the spelling bee. So anyway, so you can find me there online, or you can just contact me on Instagram. It's Yuri Gelman, URIGELMAN, and I'll reply to you right away.
Awesome. We're going to have you back again. And on behalf of Sam, myself, and you, Yuri, I look forward to many more recordings and many more hangs with you musically because you're a great cat. Thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. And on behalf of Sam, Yuri, and myself, we'll see you guys next week. Peace.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course, man.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.